This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 328 of the show where we talk aviation. If you want to follow along with us, you can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com/328. I'm Max Flight. With me is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Thanks for bailing me out last week. I appreciate it. I'm sorry I didn't get to blast Rob about drones, but it's probably better for everybody involved that I wasn't on the show with him at the time talking about that topic. So glad to be back. Looking forward to a really good show tonight talking about airliners.
Yeah, and we're glad to have you back. We missed you last week, David. Also joining us is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Well, good evening, everybody. Greetings from the Windy City, where it's chilly, and I still don't know why I always feel like I have to start out with a weather report, but I'm working on that.
All right. We're also joined by Brian Coleman, our associate producer, the best associate producer we've ever had. Hi, Brian.
Oh, it's nice being amongst the team of one associate producer that you've ever had. So that's great. Thanks for having me on again tonight and being here and doing all the stuff for you guys that I do. Just wanted to add, though, that I find it amazing. I was making fun of the airlines last week or the week before, saying how they should raise their fares. And lo and behold, I get an email today saying that I could do a transcontinental flight for $378. And just so happens I have to take a flight. So I go to look online, and it's actually $317.
Good grief.
So these people are nuts. Wow. Again, it's the same price that I paid back in the early 80s for a flight, and even with the price of oil being at, what, $65 a barrel or so, these guys are crazy.
But did you know that this is going to be in a Cessna 172? Did they tell you that part?
That you neglected to observe that little detail.
It's just going
to
take a little longer.
Yeah, maybe.
All right. Our guest this episode is Brad Sheehan. Brad is Vice President of Flight Operations at ExpressJet Airlines. Brad, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks for having me, gentlemen.
Now, Brad, you started out as a pilot many, many years ago, I hear. Is that correct?
I did, about 18 years ago. I started off, at ExpressJet, I started off as a pilot 18 years ago. I started flying actually about 24 years ago, when I was 16 years old. So it's been a long, long career and life in aviation.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to talk about flight operations and what that involves, what your responsibilities are, how that works in the context of your airline. We have that coming up. We're going to start off first with some current aviation news, including the NTSB's final report on the Japan Airlines 787 battery fire at Logan Airport in Boston. You all remember that. We're also going to talk about cracks in a 787 Dreamliner window, airport security in the TSA. Also, Brian, to your point, maybe why falling oil prices may not be a good thing. And also a little bit about airports courting avgeeks. We also have a history segment coming up. David, have you got something prepared for us?
I have some random thoughts about the upcoming new year in the history segment. So we'll discuss that when the history segment comes along.
Okay, good. Look forward to that.
Is it going to become history?
Maybe.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
How about speculative science fiction?
Ooh, I like that. That sounds very, very important.
I'm intrigued. Mystery and intrigue.
Yes. We also have an Across the Pond segment from Peter Johnson. Peter reminisces over the past 4 years, and he has a little announcement for us. And we have some listener feedback, including one that's very timely, 12 aviation books that make great holiday gifts. So we have that coming up. First, though, let's get to the aviation news. Well, our first item comes from Flight Global. This is temperature in 787 battery cells spikes in cold conditions. That's from the NTSB. Well, the NTSB did issue its final report. This is on the January 7, 2013 incident. And you'll recall ground workers, they discovered smoke and flames coming from the APU unit, the lithium ion battery, on a Japan Airlines 787. This was parked at the gate at Boston Logan. Previously, the NTSB had said that one of the battery's cells experienced an internal short circuit of some sort, and that caused a thermal runaway in that particular cell, but that then spread to the other cells and caused a full battery thermal runaway. So the report is kind of interesting, the final report. They say that there are both shortcomings in the design and in the certification, and that led to the lithium-ion battery fire. So, guys, this is kind of interesting because, I mean, this was a new technology, relatively, these types of batteries being used. And the NTSB thought that, well, maybe the process for certifying them wasn't exactly as it should be.
I was listening to an interview with Bert Rattan, and he's, I guess, well known for not liking corporate America. And he really bashed Boeing on this one, saying that it's really not the battery itself. It's the controller of the battery. And Bert, of course, talked about how at Skeld Composites, they had been using lithium ion batteries for years and have never had any issues. And it's the engineering of the controller. So I just wonder how much that has to play into it. Is Bert really full of hot air when he talks about this, or should I just never get on a 787 when it flies in cold weather or to a cold destination? I don't know.
Well, I think one of the interesting things that the NTSB said was that the FAA saw this as something new and didn't really have the experience or the means by which to assess the or certify the system. And so they do what they do in that case, which is okay, which is to shift that to Boeing and say, okay, so you tell us what we need to know about this system and demonstrate to us that it's, it should be certified. And the NTSB says that the Boeing company, they did look at multiple cell failures in the battery, but they ruled that out and they just focused on a single cell thermal runaway situation and then dealt with that. Well, as we said, what happened here was this propagated to the other cells. And so this wasn't a scenario that was contemplated by Boeing in its original report to the FAA certifying this system. So the NTSB has some recommendations as to how the process of certification should be changed to accommodate situations like this with new technologies. I don't know if there's, you know, been a situation with other technologies, you know, in the past in this regard. Maybe it hasn't been an issue. I'm thinking of things like, you know, high use of composites and things like that that represent new technologies. But the NTSB had some recommendations, mostly for the FAA, and mostly dealing with the process. But they also had a couple for Boeing and one for the battery manufacturer as well. So a process issue is how the NTSB seems to be looking at this.
Yeah, but you know what I think is kind of scary about this whole thing is that when you think in this day and age, and all of us watch way too much television, we all see way too many movies, I think, where someone says, oh, no, that situation? Nah, that can't happen. And you want to be the guy in the back going, oh, no, hang on. It can't ever happen. But if it did, what would – just take me through what it would look like if it did happen. And at least if FAA had been smart enough to say that, which it doesn't sound like they did, it's kind of scary in the sense that you have a corporate entity telling a regulator what they should be looking for. And I don't mean it to sound like, we shouldn't trust business. I don't mean that. But I'm just saying that the regulator is supposed to be a little more in touch. And you'd have thought that if they didn't understand the technology, they'd have gone to, MIT or something and said, hey, you know what? We need a consultant in here to help us figure out what the Sam Hill this means, so that we don't simply rely on the manufacturer's data. But I guess that didn't happen.
Yeah, because the folks at Tesla know absolutely nothing about lithium-ion batteries.
No, either. That's true. Yeah, that's true. I agree, Brian. I mean, I realize that the company, has experience with that. But then, did they look anyplace else other than, I don't know. I don't know what the conversations were between Boeing and the Japanese company that made the batteries and what the conversations might have been between FAA and the company that made the batteries. Maybe there were none. I don't know. I guess I would feel better if I thought there were some as opposed to, Boeing just sort of being the intermediary on the info. But, of course, the report doesn't really seem to go into that too much.
No, the NTSB says, I think this was in its press release, they say that as a result of its findings, the NTSB is recommending, now this is kind of an interesting perspective, is recommending that the FAA improve the guidance and training provided to industry and FAA certification engineers on safety assessments and methods of compliance for designs involving new technology. So they're not saying the FAA should go out, like you say, Rob, and the tap on the engineers at MIT or elsewhere to help educate them. They're saying that it still kind of goes back to the manufacturer, but the manufacturer, Boeing in this case, needed some better training as to how to conduct the safety assessment. So
I don't know. I still think that this all goes back to engineering. So they should go to MIT and other world-class universities and get some decent engineers that know this technology and understand it and can actually build a product that's not going to create a thermal runaway situation and put my butt in danger when I'm on that aircraft.
Yeah, you want to have a reasonable assurance that you're not going to experience a thermal runaway on your flight. Mm-hmm. Well, the Dreamliner, the 787, does incorporate other interesting new technologies, one of which is the windows. And this goes into our next story, which is concerning a gentleman who apparently, for whatever reason, punched one of the windows in flight and cracked it. Now, the 787 windows are pretty interesting in that they don't use shades like just about every other airliner window. It uses instead, what's sometimes called smart glass or electrochromic windows. And these have an adjustment to them that lets the passengers make them opaque or open them up and vary the amount of light that goes through. So this particular passenger punched one. Now, I think the real problem here, or the biggest problem in terms of the effect of this, was not a safety issue, right? It's not a structural piece on the inside, but it just sort of freaked out the other passengers, I think, who saw some guy punching and cracking a window and wondering if that was the last thing they were going to experience before some rapid decompression. I think that would be a pretty scary situation.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, Max. Two points on that. One is he punched the safety window, not the window itself. And the other is, as I wrote when I reviewed the 787, it's just a stupid idea having that dimmable glass.
What? Brian, are you kidding? That sounds like a brilliant idea to me.
It doesn't get dark. It doesn't black out the way the shades do. And the quantity of heat that goes through that window is crazy. So it's a bad idea. It never should have been put in that airplane.
first-person report here, right? I mean, this, yeah. You're getting this? Yeah, okay. I have to admit, I don't think I've heard anybody say that before.
No, I haven't either.
About A&A hands out little paper sheets that you could tape up to the – they're almost like Post-it notes that you could tape up over the glass to block out the sun and to reduce the heat. It's such a terrible product. But anyway, the point of the story was he actually, for whatever reason, and it didn't say in the story if he was mentally unstable or drinking too much or whatever. But yeah, he punched the safety glass and broke that. And that would be terrifying, being a passenger on a plane and seeing someone do that.
Well, but let's ask our guest, if we don't mind, so long as we don't put him in a terrible spot. But Brad, have you ever had a passenger punch out one of your airplanes?
We have not had that happen to us, largely because we do not have self-dimming windows. They're, well, self-lowering shades. But we've had some interesting passenger experiences. People try to open doors in flight, things like that. But
you're kidding!
Oh, absolutely.
Again, something that I would not want to experience on an aircraft.
It's physically impossible to do, but they do try at times.
Yeah, that's my understanding. Yeah, there is sort of a fail-safe mechanism that I get what it has to be armed or it has to be – something has to happen before the door can open.
The pressure on the door is so great. You know, at a certain point, just the square footage of the door, it's probably thousands of pounds per square inch. At a certain point, thousands of pounds of total pressure, you're not going to do it without breaking the handle.
All right. Hey, let's move on to our next story. This comes from the New York Times, considering the year in airport security with a TSA chief. The New York Times, this is from the Business Day section. They did an interview with John Pistol. He's the outgoing administrator of the TSA. I think, Rob, he moves on at the end of this year, 2014. Is that right?
That is what I believe is correct. And I'm not sure. I heard that the replacement is somebody whose last name is Shotgun, but that might not be true. Oh,
I don't know. It's just a vicious rumor.
Yeah, I know it is. No, but let's be serious. It's actually been a fairly decent year. I mean, I know that anybody that travels on the airlines, of course, blames the airline every time TSA goes nuts for whatever reason. But we can't, other than saying, why do you come to this airport? That's about all the control that an airline has over TSA. Brad, am I kind of on the right track there? I mean, you don't really have much you can do with TSA, do you?
No, I think it's a bigger deal for our mainland partners because of the ramifications it has on their passengers. But, I traveled twice over Thanksgiving, and it was flawless for me. Two major airports and very, very smooth sailing. A pre-check one way. So it can have a big impact on irritating passengers. But so I think they take it very seriously.
Did you say pre-check went away?
No, pre-check. I had pre-check one way.
Oh, one way. Oh, I see. Oh, yeah.
So I was chosen for pre-check one flight with my family, and it was some of the smoothest sailing I've ever had.
Well, apparently a lot of other passengers also like pre-check. The article mentions that more than 725,000 people have joined pre-check. What we see in this article is that while that's good for the pre-check folks and has been good for the non-pre-check folks, that may not be the case in the future. So I guess that with the pre-check lanes, if they're open, sometimes passengers who don't have pre-check are just directed over to there and can get through pretty quickly.
But yeah, and Max, having paid my $100 for Global Entry and TSA pre, it's so annoying having the family of 12 get put in front of you going through the line and not knowing what to do and going to take off their shoes. And how do I know that their random behavior methods of scanning these passengers is really working? I still, to this day, do not feel safer flying. And I do it all the time. I probably fly commercially more than all of us on this call together. And I just don't feel safer. And that's a problem I still have with TSA.
Well, what we see – oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, so you don't feel safer because of pre-check?
No. There were two separate points there. Pre-check annoys me I love pre-check when I'm there and there's other people who have gone through the process go through it. When TSA deems the lines to be too small or too short – and they guide non-pre people through the line, I have a problem with that. A, they don't know what they're doing, and how do they randomly, it seems as though they randomly select people, although they say that their behavior specialists have approved the people going through TSA pre, and that's why they've been selected out of the normal line into the pre line.
I see what you mean. That's a good point. And not to mention the fact that, of course, what you said is very true, that they never have a clue what's going on. Although lately when I've traveled, I seem to have noticed fewer and fewer people that don't seem to be pre-check people in the line, because everybody seems to know what they're doing, at least out of Midway. I don't know, but maybe that's just me. But that did absolutely drive me crazy when they were doing that initially.
Well, one of the projections that comes out of this article here is that with the increasing numbers of pre-check people, they're using the capacity of the pre-check lanes. And so over time, it becomes less and less likely that the non-pre-check folks will get shunted over to that lane. So that's great for the pre-check people, right?
Yay.
That makes Brian happy. If you don't have pre-check,
but it's not
though,
just that.
What's that?
Most of us, though, that are pre-check qualified, when we're at Midway and we see somebody that they're going to try and push in line in front of us, we growl at them. And that, you know, you show your teeth and it scares them away, so they don't do it very much.
Another point that Pistol made in this article was he mentioned that he thought that the rules that restrict carrying liquids through security, that those would eventually be relaxed. Now, I remember that, I mean, originally I thought they were supposed to be a temporary requirement because of a specific threat, but it just sort of went on and on. And
as the product of a federal government family, let me remind you, Max, there's nothing more permanent than something that's temporary.
Yeah, yeah. And this may actually affect snow globes. They talk about snow globes and, you know, it's sort of seasonal kind of a topic. So maybe snow globes will not receive so much scrutiny as they have in the past.
What about bottles of water? In the wintertime, the parking lot that I park at offers a free bottle of water when you get on the shuttle bus. And I usually end up drinking about half of it. Then I put the bottle in my pocket. I go through TSA security, and more than half of the time, they never catch the half-empty bottle of water in my pocket. I'm probably going to get put on a no-fly list now as a result of saying this, so hopefully TSA isn't listening. But those are some of the reasons why I don't feel safer with TSA.
Okay.
End of rant. Sorry.
End of rant. No, that's quite all right. Talk about safety. Another issue here that comes out is the number of guns that are found. The Pistol says that, as of mid-November, more than 1,900 guns had been discovered at checkpoints, and I think that's this year, and which is more than in all of 2013, and most of them were loaded. People are bringing loaded guns to the airport. That just blows my mind.
I can honestly say that wasn't me. So
that has been something that's always boggled my mind. I mean, TSA has a place on their website that you can go every week, and they will show you how many guns guns and other weapons they've confiscated at checkpoints. And then there's the little, and how many of the guns were loaded. And the excuses are the best part. Oh, I forgot I had my loaded .38 in my briefcase. Just slipped my mind. I mean, that's the scary part. I mean, and maybe these people really are so completely removed from the world around them that they don't think carrying a loaded gun through a security checkpoint is a big deal. I don't know. Maybe they're from Mars.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. It really is.
Well, Nampanay puts out her list every week of the, was it Strange But True in Aviation or
yes,
whatever it's called. And it's hysterical reading that every week and seeing the count of guns going through TSA. It's, again, truly terrifying. And those are only the ones they catch. Again, I ask, how many don't they catch?
Guns? Ooh, that. Well, of course, you'll never know. I mean, that's
exactly.
I gotta believe they don't miss a lot of them. I mean, do you think?
I hope.
Well, I guess we'd know if they. Well, maybe we wouldn't. All right. Well, let's talk about something a little different. Let's talk about the price of oil. We see in Barron's, the airlines, another reason to worry about cheap fuel. So we've seen the price of oil drop dramatically in the last couple of months. We know that it's an uncontrollable cost that the airlines have that represents a huge portion of their total cost. I think usually it's the largest cost element, or if not the largest, the second largest. And what they're saying here is that, well, you know what? Investors, they look too much at fuel costs when evaluating the prospects for airline stocks, and they don't look enough at the controllable expenses. And so while you see the industry enjoying profits in part because of the drop in the cost of fuel, that this may lead to some other behaviors. It mentioned the capacity discipline, they call it. You know, airlines managing the capacity. And if fuel gets cheap, maybe they won't be so motivated to worry about such things. Interesting perspective that lower fuel prices may not actually be that good for the industry.
Yeah, I was wondering what Brad has to say about that and how the fuel price works there.
Yeah, fuel's huge. Like you guys mentioned, it's the number one cost at all the major airlines. It's a little different for regional. We're using their gas. And so we're very focused on fuel conservation initiatives around fuel conservation. So it's interesting that, you know, a couple of years ago it was well over $100 a barrel, and now it's down in the mid 60s. It's definitely changing behavior, but our focus is still around how we save it.
So that's interesting. So does that come from the airlines that you know, that you support, or does that, I mean, does it affect your bottom line?
It does. It not necessarily. As a good partner, you want to demonstrate that you're taking care of their their line item. But it's important. I mean, they watch it carefully. We all measure it. We set goals around it, and we see how we do. And you know, we have several initiatives underway. Most are technology driven, whether it's routing or smarter techniques for how we use computer solutions to get, you know, to our destination on time. But saving as much, or using as much gas as we need to.
Hmm. So with prices going down, I mean, you don't want to overreact, right? I mean, it's not an instantaneous thing where, oh, the price went down the 2% yesterday, so we're going to, you know, react today. But if that trend continues, do you think that really will affect airlines' behavior?
I think so. It could, especially at the regionals. You know, the 50-seat regional jet was struggling due to the fact that, you know, it carries 50 passengers and is not the most fuel-efficient airplane on the planet. So when fuel was breaking $100, you saw Delta Airlines and a few other majors start to shift their strategy for larger capacity versus regional jets. And I think that could create a shift to where now the 50-seat RJ is not nearly as challenging of an operation as it was before. So I think it changes things dramatically, but it doesn't change our focus. I think everyone's very curious, and it's still the largest line item, even when it's, you know, 40% down.
I guess it depends on how long the price stays depressed. I mean, I don't know. I guess I have to assume that eventually it'll go back up again, but, you know, is that next month, or is that next year, or is that in 5 years? I don't think anybody knows.
Yeah, well, you know, for us, in terms of we haven't seen it change how we do things yet. In fact, you know, tomorrow morning we have a meeting with United Airlines discussing fuel conservation and our initiatives. It's a constant conversation with Delta and American Airlines. And so, you know, as a partner, it's important that we demonstrate that, you know, we're very disciplined with how we manage fuel. I'd say it's probably, you know, it will likely get a little less less focus on it when it's down at $64 a barrel. But I think it's still very important that we, you know, I think it's also, there's also a psychological piece of it now as well, where people want to see airlines that believe in sustainability and taking care of the environment. So I think it's bigger now than just the dollar sign. But, you know, I haven't yet seen them change their focus, with the exception of, yes, it does appear that, you know, as much as they can fly now, they're going to want to fly.
So if, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask, so does a possible short-term change in fuel price change fleet planning and capacity planning? So would they take what was an uneconomical CRJ route and convert it into a Brasilia route, or in this particular case, with price being low, take that Brasilia route, add more capacity, and put a CRJ in its place because it can burn gas like crazy?
I think that's part of it. I think the economics on a 50-seater were definitely strained, if not completely strained, when the price was over $50 a barrel. Now that I think there's a an excess, or there's enough 50-seaters to sustain the market and fuel's coming down, I think it does change the economics on the airplane, making it a lot more likely that instead of pushing as rapidly to see that 50-seater replaced with a 70 or a 90 or a 114-seater, I think it makes it a lot more viable for the RJ, the 50-seat RJ, to be around probably a little longer in larger numbers than you would have had a few years ago, when it would have been a big push to replace it with something that's a higher gauge and burns less per seat.
Do you guys taxi on one engine much?
Absolutely. We taxi on one engine probably the majority of the time.
Oh, okay.
So if fuel is one cost element that the airline controls or manages, are there other cost components as well that aren't really on the regional's books but are on the major's books?
It depends. We have capacity purchase agreements with the major airlines. So effectively, there's many different models to it. Sometimes the majors actually own the airplanes and we're under contract to fly the planes. Sometimes we own the planes and we fly them for under contract with the major airline. Depending upon the contracts, you can have different pieces that are passed through. In some cases, we could be paying for everything but the gas. In other cases, some of the maintenance on the engines could be power by the hour, paid for by the major.
Sure.
So it really depends on the model. Different airlines have different perspectives, because literally the RJ could be owned by the regional airline, and that RJ could be owned by Delta, being flown by its partner. So there's a couple different versions of it, and within those contracts, you can have different costs that are passed through. Really, the main pass through, though, the main is fuel.
Oh, fascinating. Okay. Let's push on to our last item. This comes from Airways News by B'nai Wilson and also, I guess, Jay Hapala. Is that how you say his name? Is that how you say Jay's name? I don't know if you guys are familiar with him.
Don't know.
And this actually comes in to us from Ken, who's a first officer with ExpressJet. And this article, it describes how two airports in particular, Washington Dulles and Miami International, they're taking on some activities to kind of court AvGeeks with special programs and social media and so forth. And they talk about the Discover Dulles program, which has included things like activities associated with the shuttles, the space shuttle Discovery, delivery to the National Air and Space Museum's Udvar Hazy Center at Dulles. They talk about the British Airways A380 inaugural event, where they gave some tours and had a contest where winners got to tour the Dulles ramp tower. And also similarly for Miami. This is a particularly interesting one, I think, in that what they've done is they've worked with spotters to set up a program, sort of an eyes on the perimeter program, where spotters would be part of the security because they're out there and being observant. But at the same time, they're using the photographs they take for them or from them, even to the extent where in their annual report, the airport held a contest to use spotter photos instead of using the stock photos that they might otherwise purchase. So two interesting airports. We've talked recently about the things that KLM has done recently for aviation enthusiasts. It's great to see stuff like this happening, getting involved with the fans, if you will.
No, I'd certainly like to see it expand into other areas, especially with the plane spotting community. It seems like there are so many of them out there, and there are so many airports that are adversarial to these people, and they could be using them to their advantage. And I don't know, I'd love to see it expanded.
I agree with Brian on this one. I mean, who knows? The next thing you might have is an airport terminal with a viewing area where people watch the airplanes. Yeah, imagine that.
Those were the good old days, weren't they?
Yeah.
All right, well, that's a trend I hope continues. Hope we get to see more of that. Right. Again, we're speaking with Brad Sheehan, the VP of Flight Operations for ExpressJet Airlines. Brad, can you kind of give us the big picture, the high-level view of what a flight operations executive has as responsibilities?
It's all secretive. I can't tell you guys. Because there's a mystique that I try to create to keep my desk looking busy and a hot cup of coffee. People think I'm busy. But no, I'm one of the luckiest guys in the world. I come to work every day, and my office is attached to about a 60-year-old hangar that was once run by Eastern Airlines and then by Delta. And so I'm attached to the airport, watching airplanes all day long. I walk through an engine shop and a tire shop, getting to my office. And I'm on the second floor, and the third floor is our operational control center, where we run every day just under 2,000 flights. We have just under 400 airplanes that are flying for Delta Connection, United Express, and American Eagle throughout North America. And it's dynamic. It's amazing. It's a lot more organized than I think probably some people think. From the outside looking in, it's probably a bit chaotic. But, you know, largely we have about, let's say there's we have just over 130 dispatchers and managers that manage this operation. And we're flying out of some of the, you know, the country's biggest airports in Atlanta and Chicago and Houston and Newark. That leaves out Detroit and Washington and Denver and a few of our other hubs. So we fly to some really dynamic airports, a lot of very complex network in the U.S. But we work very closely with those major partners to provide safe, reliable transportation. And it's an awful lot of fun, honestly. It's there's definitely days where I wish I was flying. But a lot of days I really enjoy what I do. I'm learning. It's a great opportunity to see the operation from the inside out versus years when I was kind of on the outside looking in. And, you know, my job is to support our frontline folks and try to achieve the best operation we can.
What's the thing that kind of keeps you up at night? Is it the weather? I imagine that must be the kind of the greatest potential disruptor of smooth flow.
You know, from an operational perspective for our people, for the airline running well, you know, without a doubt, we call them IROPs, irregular operations. There's definitely some times where I feel like we're an IROP more than we're a normal op. But, you know, the thing that keeps me up at night is really, it's probably the opposite. You know, things tend to, I don't worry about when the weather's really bad, we tend to see, you know, everyone kind of, you know, crosses their I's and dots their T's type of thing. Everyone's kind of brings their A game to the table. I more worry about the, you know, the airline's operation in terms of when you have a significant weather event in the Northeast, making sure people are in, you know, hotel rooms and making sure that folks get to work safely back and forth. The airline runs very well. The pilots, the mechanics, flight attendants, I mean, the professionals know what they're doing. The operators know how to make the airline run. It's really, I more worry about from the inside out, making sure that we provide our people with the tools and resources. There's not many days in the wintertime there's not a snow event in one of our major airports. And there's not many days during the summertime where there's not significant weather impacting our airport, one of our airports. So it's, you know, the weather's probably the most dynamic piece because you know, you can predict it, but it still likes to play with you. But, you know, for the most part, there's not a lot of things that keep me up at night. I fall asleep just due to sheer exhaustion. But there's lots of things that we focus on, and there's plenty of things that I think daily that I do, you know, I wouldn't say worry about, but for the most part, our folks do a good job of keeping me from worrying.
So are you saying that when there is a weather disruption and flights are canceled and that kind of thing, and so obviously the passengers are inconvenienced, does the operations center get involved in accommodating the passengers?
Usually so. That's probably one place where regionals, you know, regionals take the brunt of it from the aspect of when, you know, when the major airports get hit with weather, it really limits their capacity. So the airlines have to basically make a tough choice of what are you going to thin out to keep it running as smoothly as possible. So it makes, from a math sense, it makes sense. Typically, you thin out the regional airlines and you impact fewer customers. That's not always the case because there's some routes that may have high value customers, or you want to not cancel that city because there's not a lot of connection opportunities. But for the most part, the regionals have to handle a lot of the irregular operations. And so, you know, a weather event in Newark where the capacity is taken down from 60 flights per hour to 30 flights per hour, the majority of those flights that get taken down are going to be us. And so our folks have to be very good at managing the complexities of, you know, you've got flights canceling, you've got airplanes that were supposed to go to certain cities for maintenance, you've got crews that were supposed to be going home that day are now stuck in hotels. So the logistics of how you handle those events is very complex, and trying to limit the impact as much as possible so that tomorrow we can start off the day right. But it's a very complex, let's say, ballet of how you manage weather events, because again, you can plan around them. Typically weather gives you a heads up. And then of course there's always the Chicago Tracon fire type of thing that comes out of nowhere.
Right, yeah.
But really how we manage irregular operations is a huge driver into the reliability of the airline and how we set up the next day, or when you're in Houston and the weather's beautiful and you're trying to figure out why your captain's not there. It's because he's stuck, you know, in a ground delay program in Chicago and didn't make it through Kansas City. So we have to be very agile and very smart and understand that, you know, how to move people through the system. And it's a complex country and a complex system. But for the most part, we're getting pretty good at managing it.
Can you give us an idea of what some of the job titles or job descriptions are in the operations center, and what kinds of people, what qualities people make for good employees in those categories and those job descriptions?
Now, that's a great question. So, and if you just take our operational control center that's above me right now, there's probably about 110 people in it even tonight. The majority of those are going to be dispatchers, and the dispatchers are the ones who are literally preparing the flight routing, making sure the fuel's done properly, looking at weather, looking at NOTAMs and PIREPs, any airport challenges for the night, looking at the aircraft's maintenance status, ensuring that the paperwork the pilot gets reflects all of those dynamic pieces. Next to the dispatchers, you have a team of managers. There's always going to be a duty manager, and the duty manager is kind of like the captain of the ship, of the operation while it's moving. They're kind of hovering in orbit, watching the operation, keeping up with the mainline partners. That's a big piece of our operation, is we're constantly talking to Delta, United, and American, you know, looking and seeing what's going on in their hubs. Are there any delays at the gate, how the flights are running? You also have teams of maintenance controllers. The maintenance controllers are the ones who are answering the phone, or most of our messaging actually is electronically. So the pilots can send a message through their ACARs to the maintenance controllers, letting them know if there's anything mechanically wrong with the airplane. You also have groups of you have probably at least 30 schedulers. The crew schedulers are looking at the pilots and the flight attendants, and they're looking for anything from a pilot calls out sick, who you bring in for the replacement, to an aircraft is stuck with a weather event in Fargo, and the crew in Fargo is supposed to be in Toledo for the night. So how do you go ahead and find a connecting crew or an additional crew? So there's multiple groups in operational control that are more or less optimizing their area, but making sure they're interfacing with all the different groups so that so the operation runs as smoothly as possible. So it's a very dynamic floor. And you have a lot of different people doing a lot of different things. And, you know, what we look for in terms of personalities is also pretty dynamic. You got to find people who first of all, they enjoy aviation. There's not many times to where there's very few days that things are boring at an airline, especially with a network as large as ours. There's an airport in Canada that the runway lights are frozen and they can't turn them on. There's always something going on. So there's not many days you're sitting at your computer able to just kind of read the internet. There's always something going on. But, you know, I like to say there's kind of two major pieces to an airline employee, and that's you need to be good at the field craft, which is understanding the technical parts of your job. But there's a huge statecraft piece too, to where you need to be able to interface with the different, you know, the different divisions and the different work groups, and maintenance control has to work very well with the dispatchers to make sure that, you know, a mechanical delay has the least amount of impact, and the crew schedulers have to interface with the dispatcher. So there's a dynamic part of this job, whether you're a pilot, you're a mechanic, you're a flight attendant, you're a dispatcher, you're a scheduler, to where you really have to, you know, be a critical thinker, make good decisions, understand that, you know, perform, you know, safety and reliability are the number one thing, but we're ultimately providing a service. And that service are the people in the back of the airplane who, you know, show up, they're trying to get to weddings, funerals, work events. We always need to focus on, even though we do this a lot, ultimately the person in the back of the aircraft is why we're here. And trying to make them feel like that we're glad they're here is important.
A lot of the times we run across people, listeners, folks in our community that sort of have aspirations to an aviation career, and they think about being a pilot. And I mean, there's some challenges with that for, you know, a lot of different reasons, cost, and there's lots of things that we've discussed in the past. And one of the things we say is that, you know, there's a lot of other jobs in aviation besides being a pilot. of the crew that, that you manage, how, I don't know, maybe you don't know exactly, but what's your sense for how many of those folks have been or are pilots?
Out of our 9,200 employees, over 4,300 are pilots. But, you know, honestly, for a lot of the other jobs, there are some places where you have a sprinkling of people that some of them maybe were ex-pilots. We've had a few dispatchers that were, you know, previous military pilots where the last few years of their role in the military, they were no longer a pilot, but they still love aviation. So dispatch is a great place for them. A lot of our crew schedulers want to be dispatchers or want to be pilots. So while they're in, you know, they graduate from college and while they're working on their hours, they come here and they work as dispatchers or crew schedulers. But we're also seeing a big shift of employees who don't necessarily want to fly, but they are interested in other pieces of it. You know, even at a regional airline, you know, we still have an awful lot of structure and infrastructure to support. So, you know, I worked for 4 years in safety, and there are a lot of folks in safety weren't pilots, but they loved aviation or they were interested in some of them were engineers and other folks have degrees in aviation safety. So there's a lot of different personalities. We're starting to see a few college programs now that aren't pilot specific. It's general aviation majors. And we're seeing some of those people come to a regional because it's a good way to get into the aviation world without being a pilot. And it also opens up the rest of the airline to you. So from a scheduler, there's dispatch, there's other management roles. But I think most airlines are getting big enough. And I think we also realize now that you don't necessarily need a pilot or mechanic, where in the past you filled a lot of jobs in an airline with pilots and mechanics. Now I think we realize that you don't always need that. You can find someone off the street who has a degree in engineering or in business management or in finance or in IT, and their ability to think and make critical decisions fits in very well. And you want a group of complex, divergent thinkers. So that not everybody's from the exact same background. So I think I see very few people that come to an airline that don't in general like aviation. I think you need to like aviation to work at an airline because, again, otherwise you're a masochist. but overall, I think if you love airplanes and honestly, it's talk about the last segment of airports that have viewing decks and things like that. I mean, where we work every day, I mean, there's a big hangar in my facility and it's hard to not just look in the hangar and see these, you know, multi-million dollar, I don't want to say toys because they're not toys, but they're fun. I mean, it's great. I think people work here. There's an energy and a buzz at an airline. There's a spirit and there's definitely it's an environment that's unlike a lot of other places I've been to.
That's pretty exciting. The passion that you have for this clearly comes through. Now, you have a degree in aviation management. That's where you kind of started. Did you anticipate that this was the path you would take?
No, not at all. And I sometimes look at that and think, man, did I pigeonhole myself? My wife jokes around and says that I'm the only person she knows who does exactly what their major is. And that definitely wasn't my thought. I mean, from a young kid, I've got a 5-year-old son now, and if I was anything like him, I was a maniac. But I've always loved aviation. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know necessarily if it was military or civilian. And in fact, to my senior year of college, and I had instructed for a few years when I was at Auburn University. There's the shameless Auburn plug. But when I was at Auburn, I didn't know until literally my last quarter where I was going to go. I had friends that were doing corporate. I had friends that were going to airlines, and really ultimately made the choice mostly because I literally knew more people at the regional airline and they had a lot of good references, and I knew it had a strong culture, a strong safety culture, strong training culture. And that kind of appealed to me, you know? So yeah, I'm ridiculously passionate about it, and I've been doing it a very long time, but I've been very lucky through my career that as it's progressed, I've had a lot of different roles, and I look back now, I never would have thought when I was in college that accounting was going to be important for me later. And now I wish many days I'd paid more attention in accounting class. That aviation safety course I took, or, you know, the history course, those things in school didn't always, I didn't know how pertinent they'd be later in life. I'm very lucky that, my path has kind of followed what I've always been interested in. Opportunity is not always as great for everybody else. And I'm just lucky that most of the time when the music stopped, I had a chair, but, it's been very good to me. And I never, ever saw myself in this position, but it's, either through other people's bad decision-making or luck, I've ended up in a pretty decent place.
Hey, Brad, it's really interesting. You talk about careers. And I think a lot of people look at the regional saying, well, it's a stepping stone to get into the majors or to do something else. Can you talk a little bit about people that have actually made careers, such as yourself, at a regional?
Sure. I mean, when I started here, I never, ever would have said I'm going to, you know, be at ExpressJet for 18 years. Originally Atlantic Southeast Airlines, now ExpressJet for 18 years. You know, so of our pilot group, there's about 20 to 30% of our pilots who I think if you ask them, they're not going to leave. And so that's, I think that's a different expectation. I think most people believe that the regionals are a stepping stone or a feeder to the mainline carriers. And there's definitely some truth to that simply because there's so much opportunity and the aircraft only gets so big before people start looking at other places to go. But, you know, we're very lucky at ExpressJet. Not every regional has this. But, you know, we have a good core group of our pilots who, you know, perhaps, you know, age or just they like living in their base. They like their where they're at. They like their quality of life. They don't plan on leaving. So, you know, we really like to support both, right? We want to make sure that we have both the quality of life for someone who wants to come to a regional and stay here, whether they're retired military or this is a second career or they just enjoy where they live and what they're doing. And we also want to make sure that we support the folks that, you know, their dream is to work at a Delta or a United or an American or a JetBlue. So we want to make sure we support both. But, you know, we really do have an interesting mix of people who are here and they want to retire here. They want to spend the rest of their career here. You know, we have, very good salaries. We have many pilots making well into the six figure range. So, you know, although that's not what everybody wants, it's there's plenty of people, I think, who come here after a few years. They're enjoying what they do and they enjoy, the seat they're flying in the airplane. And they don't want to leave. So, again, we have a little bit of both, but I think most people don't realize that we do have an awful lot of, we call them lifers, but we do have an awful lot of folks who don't plan on leaving.
Hey, Brad, can you tell us what the minimums are for someone? Well, obviously, it has to be an ATP now to even get hired. So, but are you seeing people just barely making it, or are there people that you're looking at regularly that are way more experienced than that?
You know, it's definitely getting tougher. The new first officer qualification rules, which raise the minimum towards 1500 hours, and it comes down from there depending upon, where you went to school and your accredited training programs. If you went to an Embry-Riddle or an Auburn, or you went to a North Dakota or a flight safety, there's no doubt that the irony is, you know, we mentioned earlier that fuel prices are coming down to, you know, levels we haven't seen in a decade. And there's going to be a, you know, gigantic demand to fly, and we're potentially looking at one of the, you know, greater pilot shortages. And I'm sure you guys have been discussing the rumors of the impending pilot shortage for decades. But, you know, there's something close to 20,000 major airline pilots in the U.S. retiring in the next 10 years, and there's only about 16,000 regional pilots. So if you look at the next 10 years, there's a large gap just in the U.S. You know, that doesn't include the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pilots that will be hired in Asia and other parts of the world. So there's going to be a significant demand in the next 10, 15 years for pilots. And what we're not necessarily seeing yet is the supply demand curve catch up. It used to be, even from my limited couple decade experience, that anytime you saw the demand of pilots within about 6 months, it started to catch back up. The hard part now with the 1500 hour rule and first officer qualifications is the gap to go from, you know, let's say zero to hero, to get to the, you know, place where you can learn to fly to where you can get, you know, be competitive to get hired at a regional. It's now significantly widened. And so I do believe it'll catch up because when people look at that and realize the odds, the numbers, the significant, you know, the major airlines are getting healthy at a time to where there's going to be a lot of retirements. There's a lot of upside for people interested in aviation. And that doesn't even begin to touch, you know, corporate travel and a lot of the other opportunities in aviation. All of that movement creates more jobs for mechanics, more jobs for dispatchers, more jobs for schedulers. There's a lot of opportunity. For me, that's why this is so important. You know, getting people interested in aviation. I think I look forward and see nothing but good times ahead. But translating that into someone right now who's in grade school or high school or college or on a career they're not necessarily enjoying, who's thinking about aviation, there's no doubt that to get to the first officer qualifications of today, it's a significant step you have to take. And I think in the past, pilots could aspiring pilots could look at regionals and say, "I'm sorry, the investment's just too great for the first year pay or second year pay." But opportunity to me is not that first year or two. Opportunity is what an industry offers. And this industry, I look forward to see, you know, an unprecedented level of opportunity in front of us. That's actually going to be a huge challenge for the regionals, because we have to staff this as the majors start to hire mostly our pilots. So it's a great time to be in aviation, I think, or interested in aviation, regardless of what you're, if you want to fly in the front, the back, if you want to maintain, or work in a support role.
Especially if you take the long view.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the last 10 years have been tough. I mean, all the major airlines went through bankruptcy. There was very little growth or movement at the majors. The regionals had more or less kind of tapped out in the mid-2000s with their fleets. So there wasn't a lot of movement. There weren't a lot of pilots getting hired at the majors. There weren't a lot of regionals hiring for you know, the last 10 years or so. And now, literally, very quickly, things are turning around. So there's a lot of movement. And, you know, there's always that but if scenario that could happen out there. But there's no doubting that we've already reduced a lot of capacity. There's thousands of fewer flights today than there were 15 years ago. And so I don't think you're going to see any I don't think there's much of a risk for a further capacity reduction. The big risk is going to be, honestly, you know, there's roughly 200 cities in this country that are only served by a regional airline. And so over and I think it's over 50 I think it's 51-ish% of all flights in the U.S. are flown by regional carriers. So, you know, this country depends upon regional carriers to fly and to connect a lot of cities. So I think it's very important that, you know, I don't think we necessarily take a lot of pride in our air transportation system in the U.S., especially in the regional carriers. And so I think as people look forward and see that, you know, the times are changing, the very different, let's say, infrastructure and opportunities at the regionals, and then huge potential at the major airlines. And that doesn't even mean, you know, the low cost carriers, the JetBlues and the Virgin Americas and the Southwest, Spirits and Allegiance. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of movement right now, which I think is good for everything that has to do with aviation. That leaves out UAVs and all the other stuff going on around this. It's an interesting time ahead. Commercial space, I mean, there are very few aspects of aviation that to me, I don't look at and go, man, it's just a great time to be watching it happen.
Yeah, but do you know how much Amazon's going to pay guys to drive drones? Come on. Didn't you see that ad? What'd they say, Max? 100 grand or 150 grand?
I didn't see that one, Rob.
That was out a couple of weeks ago. And Amazon said, you know, don't worry about your airline career. Just drive a drone.
Well, you know what? It was a year ago, I believe, I was talking to an adjunct professor at one of the big aviation colleges.
And okay, hold it. You fly a drone. You don't drive it.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Rob. So is that like you drive your Cessna? You're serious?
So I've got to work on the marketing part. I thought drive a drone kind of rolled off your tongue. Anyway, I'm sorry, Brad, you were saying.
No, it's a very good point. But, you know, one of the an adjunct professor at one of the major, you know, aviation colleges is pointing out that more students had shown up and had expressed their major as unmanned systems than as manned systems. They were seeing a significant shift in people who, because the investment's a lot less. You don't have to pay nearly as much money to learn to fly a drone that you do need to learn to fly a commercial airplane. So, you know, there was a significant shift even at the universities to see that, look, this could be challenging. But I think, you know, things tend to balance themselves. So if there's a demand for people to fly and there's a shortage of pilots, eventually they're going to catch up, whether it's paying the pilots more money or the ticket prices go up. But I don't think people are going to expect in the next decade that there's going to be less service. And so it'll get there. You know, my question is just making sure that, you know, we're right now. I mean, this year we took two airplanes, two of our RJs to air shows. And a big piece of that is we want people to see the airplanes and to understand that, you know, who's flying those planes and it's, you know, it's pilots from their local community. We want people to see RJs and to look at that airplane and realize it's not that far out of their reach. We want to hire great people and we want to find the, you know, I always say it expressly, like, and this isn't a plug. It's just literally, you know, we'll go out of business before we're going to hire people that don't follow our values and that don't have the skills and the capability that we want. But we know they're out there. It's just making sure the people in the industry or people outside the industry, excuse me, people that are thinking about this as a career, that they actually even know it's a potential for them and know there's a need.
So, Brad, along that theme, we've done a lot of work here at the Airplane Geeks about promoting women in aviation. Are you guys doing anything particular to attract women or train them or give them special opportunity to promote them within the field of aviation?
We do. So we are there's several, you know, different groups we're a part of or we partner with. Women in Aviation is one of them. There's several different other associations that represent pilots and minority pilots. We are very active, and we make it very clear that this field is for everyone. I believe there's probably the biggest fear is more the cost of getting into it. But we make it very clear, and we're very active. We've had our pilot recruiters attend the Women in Aviation Conference every year for the last several years. So we absolutely promote diversity, promote inclusion as much as we possibly can. We have the Twitter site, Twitter feed. We have a Facebook page, recruiting Facebook page. I mean, social media is a huge part of what we do. And I feel like we have, the good thing for us is a lot of our female pilots or minority pilots become ambassadors for us. And then even when they move on to major airlines, it's a very vocal group to make sure that they are helping to generate or to let's say just to get push the interest down into the next generation of pilots. So there's very few places that we're not pushing hard to attract. And there's no doubt that I think, airlines, like many organizations, tend to kind of fit certain cultures for a long time. We're trying to change that as much as we can, and having inner city school kids come and visit the hangar as much as we possibly can, doing outreach to colleges and more rural parts of states and the city to try to get people to look at this and realize that really anyone with an interest and a passion and a desire can get involved in this. It doesn't matter what you look like. It doesn't matter your skin color. It doesn't matter how big or tall you are. What matters really is your passion, and what matters is really your drive.
Fantastic, Brad. I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us and our listeners. Now, if they want to learn more about ExpressJet, there's the website, expressjet.com. And you also mentioned ExpressJet on Facebook, which I see is a nice active page. Any other places you would direct people to for more information about ExpressJet?
No, that's perfect. Facebook.com. We also have the Facebook.com/ExpressJet Pilot Recruiting and Future Pilots. And then we have ExpressJet Pilots on Twitter. So a few different places. We are hiring pilots. We're hiring mechanics and dispatchers and crew schedulers. It's a lot. It's a great time to get in aviation, and I greatly appreciate the time, gentlemen.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure having you. Thanks again.
Hey, actually, Brad, before you go, I just have one quick question that I was going to try to ask before. But looking at the app, the Common App page, I had noticed that a competitor airline of yours is bringing people not just into the right seat, but it says that they will hire them into the left or the right seat. And I'm just curious if that would ever be something you guys consider, or if hiring captains off the street is just kind of verboten in your place.
In my opinion, it is, there's nothing unsafe about it. I think part of an organization is not just that you find people that are technically proficient. It's your culture. It's your values. It's that you've been there long enough to understand how the airline runs and operates. And look, there's no doubt it our upgrade time is right now it's 7 years. It takes a good amount of time to become a captain at ExpressJet, but we think we think it's worth it. There's no doubt there's going to be pilots that want to chase quick upgrades or go work at other airlines, and that's fine. I understand it. I couldn't see us doing it. Part of the issue with our captains is they know how we work. They know how we operate. They know our rules. They know our expectations. And I think from my perspective, from the mainline partners, they know that our crews have been around for a while. They know how the system works. So it's not something we do. I know other airlines tend to do it. But, different strokes for different folks. Different airlines have different cultures, and their needs are different than ours. And so, nope, currently we're not. We're hoping to get upgrade moving on our captains, on our first officers as quick as they can. And we have a lot of very experienced. I mean, our average seniority, our average pilot's been with the airline for over 10 years, average pilot. So on our dual class product, our bigger RJs, the average longevity is over 15 years. So we have a decent amount of experience, and we believe that's actually one of our strengths. You're not going to progress as fast through our seniority list, and that's not for everybody. But I think what we offer is stability and experience and a capability that not many others can match.
But with such seniority, how do you deal with the salary issue, or is salary just such a small part of your cost structure where that bit really doesn't matter?
That's a great question. You know, for us, because fuel is a pass-through cost for us, our number one line item does become employee wages. So it is a big issue for us. There's no doubt about it. Having a more senior workforce, a more senior pilot group, more senior maintenance group, you know, more mature contracts, it absolutely makes us more expensive. I believe the way we counter that is with the product. You know, we can offer a capability, we can offer an agility that others can't. And I think, honestly, you know, not everybody looks at it, but I think most passengers want to believe that what's in the front of their aircraft is an experience and a capability that I believe we offer. So there's no doubt there's a cost side to it. I think what it also allows us to have is a quality and a reliability piece that balances that. There's no doubt that, you know, we have to have there has to be a balance. We can't be so far out of line that that it makes it hard to compete. But in general, having some of that work group that wants to stay around, that's good for us. If you have, you know, if it's a constant conveyor belt of people coming in and going out, and you're not retaining some of that, that's difficult. You know, the good news is we can have a first officer who's new to the airline business, but the person they're sitting next to has been doing this for a couple decades. That we believe is part of what, you know, helps make our culture successful and sets us apart from others. It's not always an easy thing to manage, because there's no doubt that quite often what people are looking for is price. But I think what we can offer in return for that cost is hopefully unparalleled ability.
And now here's Pete Combs to tell us about the Flight Plan podcast from the National Business Aviation Association.
Hi, I'm Pete Combs, and if your business is flying, then you'll want to check out NBAA's Flight Plan. Whether you're flight crew, cabin crew, line crew, or maintenance, NBAA's Flight Plan is 5 minutes well spent on topics that range from safety to education to procedures both new and old. You'll find us on Apple's iTunes website or at the home of business aviation, nbaa.org.
Thanks, Pete. All right, David Vanderhoof, our official airplane geeks historian, you've got the mic.
Okay, I have been struggling with my disease, which is diabetes, and I'm a little overwhelmed with work, two podcasts, etc. So, and over time, I've gotten bored. I'm tired of doing a history segment. Though I'm going to ask feedback to our listeners, because you're far more important than me, I'm going to give you some things to think about. What I'd like to do maybe once a month, or probably once a month, is talk about things like this. High and the Mighty, the Flying Leathernecks, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, the Sound Barrier, 12 O'Clock High, the Dam Busters, Flight of the Intruder, Airport, The Right Stuff, Jet Pilot, Bridges at Toko Ri, or Iron Eagle, or, if necessary, Top Gun. I'd like to start a movie review segment, kind of, where we'd pick a movie for the month, and then I'd review it, and we'd get your feedback, too. And instead of doing a history segment that week, we do a movie review. All of us AvGeeks have our favorite movies, you know. If you notice, I left out Airplane, because that's on the top of everybody's list. Top Gun is another one that seems to be on the top of the list. But there's a lot of other really great aviation movies out there. And the other night, I got to watch an episode of Black Sheep Squadron with Robert Conrad and went, you know, this is pretty good. And I think about things like Flying Leathernecks, or which is Corsairs, or, you know, The Sound Barrier, which talks about Great Britain trying to break the sound barrier. All of those are really good movies, and I think we need to be a more cultured AvGeek group, or airplane geeks. So let me know what you think. Should we pick a movie and have a discussion about it over time? It would let me do something other than trying to find 10,000 words for an airplane for the week. So let me know. And what I'd do, like I said, we'd pick it in advance, and then that way everybody would have time to watch it, and we could talk about it, and you could give us our feedback, so we could have an interaction thing on Facebook or Twitter or So let me know. Send us an email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com and let me know what you think. So this is David M. Vanderhoof, hopefully your movie critic going forward, signing off.
Oh, a new title, Reinventing David Vanderhoof, kind of. That's fascinating. So, yeah, look for people's feedback on this one. What do you think, Rob?
David, I was going to vote for Always.
Oh, really good one.
Yeah.
Well, and I was going to say, I think he started off doing This Day in Aviation, where you talked about a plane that did something famous that first week. Then you changed it to The Airplane of the Week. So doing another modification going to movie critic seems like a great natural evolution. And my recommendation is going to be the John Wayne classic Flying Tigers, because that's the first movie I remember watching with my father, who got me terribly excited about aviation. And it actually ties into one of the stories that's coming up here in a little bit.
Yeah, this is a great idea, David. Really, I think it's good to change things up from time to time. So, yeah, we'll see what the listeners think, what our community thinks. And as David mentioned, you can get in touch with us a lot of different ways. You can email us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Of course, you can find Airplane Geeks on Twitter, our Facebook page, and so forth. So give us some feedback. All right, Steve and Grant are off this episode. No Australia desk report. I think there's something about them having to spend some time doing their day jobs or their real jobs. So we'll look for them to return next week. We do have an Across the Pond segment from Peter Johnson. So here he is.
Over 4 years ago, I joined the team here at the Airplane Geeks, and since then, I've played a small part in almost 200 episodes. By no means comprehensive, but here's a small selection of my fantastic guests.
Oh my gosh, I have to tell you, this has been the big controversy, and the question, is it Airbus or Boeing? I've spent my entire life on the Boeing aircraft, and I absolutely love the 747-400. But now, flying the A330, we've got pilots that either love it, or they hate it. And I actually really like the airplane. It's the new technology, fly-by-wire.
Sort of set the standard for a new way of travel. The aircraft was introduced in 1964 as really the first second-generation jet airliner. And it's a very sleek design, which still looks fairly modern, even though it's over 40 years old.
It was for sure exciting. I would say a cocktail of strong emotions and extreme performances that was common to three generation of pilots since the 50s.
Yeah,
it is something that happened in November 2000 at Grosseto Air Base here in Italy, that was the home of the operational conversion unit on the Starfighter since 1965. And of course, as every aircraft enthusiast knows, the F-104 was an extremely powerful interceptor that could fly at stratospheric heights and speed higher than Mach 2.
Yeah.
And I can affirm that a takeoff in a Starfighter is at least unforgettable, as the speed increases dramatically and the perception of movement is distorted, and the feeling is just like laying flat in a rocket fired towards the sky.
The whole aim was to try and get the quality of British Airways thinking, presentation, branding across some very disparate and small airlines who may have gone their own way without this sort of control.
Neil, congratulations from everyone here on the Airplane Geeks, and welcome back.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be back on again as a private pilot.
Like most young kids, I was always interested in aerospace at an early age, but a couple of things solidified that interest for me. One was I lived near the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, and so was exposed to their flying on a regular basis. Then when I was 16, we went to Walt Disney World and to the NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida, and we got to see the rockets and the launch pads, and it was very exciting for me.
But taxiing the Swordfish is fairly straightforward. It's got such a big wing area. It's quite easy in a crosswind for the wings to lift.
Yeah.
And you've got automatic slats, which are aerodynamically operated. But once you get the aircraft airborne, on the takeoff, it's very easy to keep straight. It's got a really big fin.
Yeah.
Lots of authority on the rudder.
Yeah.
Takes off at 60 knots, climbs at 70. cruises around at 90 knots. I'd say the most difficult part of it is affecting a very nice landing.
Yeah, we've got two Rosenbauer Panthers, which, as you say, we've just had them just over a year now. They're still like frontline major foam tenders. Yep. They're capable of producing around 5,000 litres per minute to, you know, an aircraft incident to a fire, say.
If you look around, and the frequent flyers, they really don't mind, because KLM says the ticket price is going down. We take the baggage fee to we take off. So if you fly without bags, well, you save 15 euros, not exactly, but you save on that.
Everybody's life depends on you. The men up front will be too busy trying to get it down in one piece. They won't help you. You've got to get those passengers out.
Yeah. I'm actually working at the Barcelona control tower. We are about 80 air traffic controllers, talking on six different frequencies.
Right, okay.
Those frequencies, are we call two local frequencies, which manage the, which control the runways operations. Yeah. In fact, in Barcelona, we use a parallel runway configuration.
The Ali test pilot, Keith Dennison, flies everything from a Blériot monoplane via a Hurricane to, he was chief test pilot at BA Systems developing the Eurofighter.
And with the amount of traffic we have in Geneva, almost exclusively Airbuses and Boeings and the regional jets, it will just not be possible anymore for the flying school to survive there.
Well, I really feel that Concorde deserves something more artistic than I've seen.
And the angle was, in a little while, the public are going to be flying at Mach 2 sipping champagne. In the meantime, what's it like to fly supersonic?
But I think it's great that Finnair took their own initiative and looked at the use of cooking oil. I found it very amusing and really pretty cool, you know, that.
As was said a few weeks ago by Robert Sumwalt, a man has to know his limitations, and so I've reached that point where I have to take a break from the Across the Pond segment. It isn't because I've fallen out of love, it's just because I cannot hold up the workload of what I think's required to keep this segment an enjoyable listen. I've had a great time. I've met military, commercial and test pilots, industry leaders, engineers, inventors, authors, enthusiasts, just to name a few. But it's without any remorse the most enjoyable as well as heart-rendering content I've brought to you, and from all the feedback we've had, the most popular segment I've produced, and that of course is the interview with my father.
And that happened to my albacores, parts for the Spitfires and Barracudas. Little did I know I was making things that perhaps I'd fly in later. Although I was only 14, they asked me, would I do night work? Which was completely illegal, but that's the war.
And your first flight was in a Tiger Moth.
That's right, that's correct, in Southend. I always remember it was quite exhilarating and everything like that.
Probably without this segment, I may never have recorded that interview. We've all looked at how we've engaged in the aviation sector and at those who have encouraged that enthusiasm in us. And for me, it was my father. And 5 years ago, I reinvigorated that interest through the team here at the Airplane Geeks. I only hope that during the past 4 years, I've helped in some way to foster your interest and brought you something to keep your interest going. I'm going to have a few weeks off now to recuperate, collect my thoughts and start up again in 2015. I'm sure it's not the last you'll hear from me here on the Airplane Geeks, but until next time, I really would love to thank Max, Steve, David, Grant, Rob and Brian for the opportunity they've given me to indulge in my passion for aviation. Never forget, they do this for no return other than your enjoyment every single week. So finally, I'll leave you with Petty Officer Johnson, Telegraphist Air Gunner, Royal Navy, my inspiration for the love of aviation. Isn't that why we're all here, listening, now?
And so, some of your memories are fond ones and some not so fond. What do you take from all of that?
Oh, I learned a lot. I learned about camaraderie. I learned about always trying to do your best at the time. And the greatest thing, I think, was I made my father proud. And he was very, very proud. The thing that I always loved the Navy, even now, I go around, I've got my badge on my blazer, and I'm always so proud when somebody asks me.
Well done, Dad.
Thanks very much.
Rob, I think Peter has brought quite a good collection of interesting, fantastic folks to this podcast. We really want to thank Peter a lot for all that he's done.
Yeah, but when he takes a break, who are we going to have to pick on in Europe?
Yeah, we'll just have to save them up until he returns.
Yeah, Max, I also want to mention, well, two things. Boy, this seems to be my show of mentioning two things. One is, if I was a halfway decent assistant producer, associate producer, heck, whatever my title is, I would have been able to tell you off the top of my head what episode Peter did the interview with his father, because that was a fantastic interview. And I really wish that I'd have that, so people would, that'll be my homework assignment, so people could go back and listen to that episode. And the second thing is, it's just been great having Peter contribute to the show, and looking forward to him coming back and doing another segment in the future.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we're very grateful to Peter. It was also fun to listen to the voices that he played just now on his segment, and try to think of how many of them I could identify by name. And quite a lot, not every one of them, though, I have to say, but quite a lot of them, actually. It was an interesting retrospective of the amazing folks he's talked to. So, again,
yes, a stroll down memory lane.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's move on to some listener mail. Let's do a couple of ones very quickly and get on to two others that might take a little bit more time. So just briefly, Tom sent us a link from the dailybreeze.com, a World War II Flying Tigers photo exhibit to open in Monterey Park. We'll put the link to that article in the show notes.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to going to that this weekend.
Oh, are you? Oh, well, then you'll have to bring us a report next episode, if you would.
Yeah, it's just right down the 15, 20 minutes, depending on traffic.
Oh.
I'm in L.A. Yeah, it could be 2 hours. it's literally just down the road from me, and absolutely looking forward to it. And that was the Flying Tiger reference that I made before.
Oh, I just made the connection. Okay, good.
Ding,
good.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We heard from Patrick actually a couple of times. Two things. One is an article. This one is from the Daily Mail. This is the longest, the longest article title I think I've ever seen. This is, "Is this proof mysterious bangs heard on both sides of Atlantic were caused by a top-secret U.S. jet? Footage of hypersonic engine in action reveals it sounds almost identical to unexplained noises." So it's to it. David had to peel off, but there were some noises heard, apparently. There's a type of engine, a pulse detonation engine, that has kind of a sound to it, and this article looks at, well, maybe that's what people heard. So if you're into that sort of thing or conspiracies, take a look at this article. We'll put that in the show notes. And then Peter also put in or sent us a link. This is a Vimeo video titled "Just Simply Wanderers," and well, I'll let you listen to the description. This says, "Wanderers is a vision of humanity's expansion into the solar system based on scientific ideas and concepts of what our future in space might look like, if it ever happens. The locations depicted in this film are digital recreations of actual places in the solar system built from real photos and map data where available." And then it says, "Without any apparent story other than what you may fill in by yourself, the idea of the film is primarily to show a glimpse of the fantastic and beautiful nature that surrounds us on our neighboring worlds, and above all, how it might appear to us if we were there." So that link's in the show notes. This is really cool. If you like space, it's also narrated by a former professor of mine, so I sort of had a personal connection when I listened to this. It's pretty cool. Very cool.
You studied under Carl Sagan?
Yeah, he was my astronomy professor back a long time ago. Long, long time ago.
Wow, he has such a distinctive voice. And when I heard that, when I was watching the video and I heard his voice, I'm like, I wonder if that's Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
No, they couldn't have gotten him to do this. But that's Carl Sagan.
It is.
That was
yeah.
so cool.
Yeah, very yeah. distinctive voice. Yeah, I did. About three words into it, I knew that it was Sagan. Let's see. We heard from Srinand. Now, he sent us a really interesting email. And what he's done is taken the notion held by some people that there's no more romance left in aviation, right? That it's too boring. And he says, well, maybe not. So what he's done is he's put together a list about the romance in aviation. And we'll give you a couple of these, and we'll put all of them in the show notes. And what Srinand is hoping is that our listeners will maybe contribute some of their own thoughts to this. So I'll let each of you actually read off one or two of these, maybe your favorites or just maybe some random ones, and we'll just do a couple of them. I'll start off with the first couple. He says that the romance is when you get to see day, dusk, and night all at the same time from your office window. That, of course, being the airplane. Another example, the romance is when you depart on an overcast, gloomy, dark day, break out on top, and realize the sun really does exist. So, Rob, have you got a couple more examples from this list of the romance in aviation?
Sure. I think one that I liked here was, the romance is when you check in at 37,000 feet and whisper, honey, I'm home.
Isn't that great?
Another one, let's see. Let me see. There was another one there that I really grabbed. Oh, the romance is when you fly from Moscow to Houston. 50 years ago, you wouldn't have had to do it in a spy plane and fly high enough to be out of range of communist missiles. Or when you fly across the Atlantic without batting an eyelid. 80 years ago, they were handing out rewards for this sort of thing. And I want to say, it was really nice to hear from Srinand, because he and I met 4 years ago. I believe it was from the Airplane Geek Show, wasn't it, that he kind of hitched a ride with me from Chicago up to Air Venture in Oshkosh. Yes. And we had a nice old chat, because he had just finished his sort of cadet training at Singapore Airlines. And he thought he was going to be on the 777, and then we kind of lost touch with each other until now. So he's been flying the 777 for all these years, for 4 years now. And apparently, I'd say he likes it.
Yeah, very much so. Let's just do a couple more real quick. Brad, do you have one or two from this list that sort of resonates?
I think the mention of the airline flight from Moscow to the U.S. is an interesting one. I think in general that, you know, airplane to me is still a time machine. You know, it still gets you from A to B amazingly fast. You know, and years ago it took generations of families to get that far.
Right.
It's a time machine. I mean, it's an amazing device.
How about you, Brian? One or two from this list?
Yeah, one that has a little personal meaning to me, because I actually got a narration very similar to this once on a flight. The romance is when you fly over Europe on a clear day, within minutes you've seen the Alps, the Eiffel Tower, and Big Ben. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my flight was flying into London, and the chief purser gets on, and he was living in London and gave a narrated tour of the approach into Heathrow, and it was absolutely fantastic.
Wow.
And then the one right below that is also great. The romance is when people tell you it's a small world. And having seen the length of the Pacific, you beg to disagree.
Yeah, this is a great list, Srinand. We really appreciate it. Well, there's many, many more, and we'll put all of these in the show notes. And again, encourage you all listening to, give us your feedback, add to the list, give us your suggestions, and let's see what we come up with as a community. I think this is fantastic. And then finally, another list. This came from Ace Abbott, author, past guest. And he says the best holiday gifts money can buy are books. He says they're inexpensive. If you have friends, neighbors, relatives, or airport or pilot colleagues who may be even remotely interested in aviation, the following list of aviation books will pleasantly entertain these people. So in honor of the 12 days of Christmas, here's Ace Abbott's list of 12 great aviation books. And runs the gamut, Jonathan Livingston Seagull, Falling to Earth, Fighter Pilot, Rules of Engagement, his own book, The Rogue Aviator, which is a fantastic, fantastic book. Chuck Yeager, Area 51. So it's a nice, nice list, and we'll put those in the show notes as well. I encourage you to take a look at those and see if there's something that's of interest either to you or to someone you know that has a passion for aviation. So thanks to Ace for that.
And Max, one other book that I wanted to add to the list is a book called Artful Flying. And it's a fantastic book, not only for aviation, but I've read it and can apply so many of the lessons to business as well.
Great. Okay. All right.
Oh, well, and I was expecting a I was expecting a comment from Rob on that one, because Rob, if he remembers, I know he's so old he has a hard time remembering this stuff, actually reviewed the book.
I remember that. And you know, it's funny. I thought you were going to mention the author, but you didn't. How come?
Oh, I didn't write that down.
I have to go grab my copy. Wait, it's...
There are three names to it. Michael somebody.
Oh, Michael Maya Charles. Yep, there you go. Yeah, no, in fact, it's funny because I met him a few times after that. And I know other people that say that they read his book once a year just for all of the insights into flying. It's not Wolfgang Langschwitz Stick and Rudder, but it's pretty darn close. Really is. So if you haven't read it, it's worth getting.
All right. Well, with that, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane
Thank
Geeks
goodness.
Podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was my mic on?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. For those of you listening at home, this has been quite a challenge. We've lost the internet a couple of times. And actually, we have no idea how long this is going to turn out to be, because we have some big gaps in the middle that we have to cut out. This has been episode 328 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com, or you can go straight to the episode show notes. That's at airplanegeeks.com/328. We want to thank our guest, Brad Sheehan, Vice President of Flight Operations with ExpressJet Airlines. Again, Brad, thanks so much for a great conversation.
Enjoyed every second of it. Thanks for the invite, guys.
You can find out more about us and our contributors at airplanegeeks.net. That has links to our websites, the recent episodes, tweets, blog posts, contact information, and more. And that's for this podcast, Airplane Geeks. Also, Rob's Jetwine blog, the UAV Digest podcast that David and I do. Also, his What Just Flew By blog, and the Plane Crazy Down Under and Aviation Extended podcasts, all that at airplanegeeks.net. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night, everybody.
Ready. These guys are really mean. They are grumpy. You remember, you know where Grumpy Cat came from? That used to be Max's cat. It was a nice cat before Max got it, and now it's Grumpy. Is David coming, or is he here?
David's here.
Oh, I'm here, but I don't bother when the motor mouth is going.
Hey, I am just a high energy person. Okay. So that's all right.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's going to question that, Rob.
Okay.
All right. That's pretty good for an old man, you know.
Well, that's true.
That much energy.
Heck, you realize I'm going to be almost 50 here, so.
Yeah, right. You wish.
50 plus what?